And welcome to Power Play. I'm Todd Vander Hayden. Joyce Napier is away today. Coming up on the show, boots on the ground, more at the ready in British Columbia.
We have thousands more personnel on standby, ready to support the province. Our Canadian Armed Forces and the entire federal government will continue to do whatever it takes to step up in this time of need.
Military relief arrives in BC as the province battles devastating flooding, 5 days and counting into this disaster. Where will the military be deployed and what sort of risks remain? We'll get the latest on that coming up. Plus, finally, vaccines are coming for Canadian kids.
Canada will begin receiving doses Sunday with all the 2.9 million doses received by the end of next week.
Health Canada approves the Pfizer vaccine for children aged 5 to 11. Doses are coming fast. But is Canada ready for the rollout? We'll bring in the doctor in charge of Canada's vaccine approvals. And easing travel restrictions.
Canadians taking short trips of less than 72 hours outside of Canada will be able to return to Canada without having to take a molecular test.
At the end of the month, fully vaccinated Canadians will be able to ditch those expensive PCR tests when they come back from short trips. But when could the tests drop altogether? When will other restrictions be lifted? Canada's Health Minister, Jean-Yves Duclos, is standing by. This is Power Play, so let's get to the players. A COVID-19 game changer, Health Canada has finally authorized a COVID vaccine for kids aged 5 to 11, about 3 million or so children in that age group in our country. And the doses are coming quick. The first shipment of pediatric doses of the Pfizer vaccine arriving on Sunday. Total of 2.9 million doses expected to come by the end of next week. Enough to cover all first doses. Another big headline today on the pandemic. As of November the 30th, the federal government will no longer require fully vaccinated Canadians and permanent residents to provide proof of a negative PCR test after returning from short trips abroad under 72 hours. Of course, the test is expensive. It places an extra burden on travelers. After months of pressure from border communities and businesses desperate to welcome American tourists, what about the other testing rules that are still in place? Let's ask Canada's Health Minister, Jean-Yves Duclos, who joins me now. And the first shipment of Pfizer's pediatric COVID doses arriving on Sunday. Minister Duclos, good to have you with us. How soon can you actually get those out to the provinces once they arrive in our country?
Well, good evening, Todd, and good evening to everyone listening. And indeed, the very good news that you mentioned today, I think, is going to be of great interest to millions of families and children. As you mentioned, 2.9 million children will now be eligible to be vaccinated. And as you've mentioned, these doses will come on Sunday. They'll arrive on Canadian soil on Sunday, and we expect them to be distributed very quickly. I've spoken to almost all of my colleagues, Minister of Health in Canada over the last few days. They're all very ready. So we expect those doses to start being administered in the week after.
Okay. We know that Health Canada has authorized, Minister Duclos, a three-week interval between first and second doses. I'm curious whether there will be enough doses for a second shot if provinces want to get children fully vaxxed by Christmas.
Well, there will be enough shots to be administered. As we mentioned, 2.9 million doses will be arriving in the week to come. And that covers everyone, obviously, the 2.9 million children aged 5 to 11. As you also said, the National Advisory Committee on Immunization recommends an eight-week distance period between the first and the second dose, which would bring us towards January, February for the second dose in the majority of cases. And there will be enough doses for all children for the second dose.
Are you hoping to have as many children as possible with at least one dose, let's say by Christmas? I mean, obviously depends on how it rolls out in the province, but give me a best-case scenario if you can.
That's our hope, and I'm confident about that. Again, having spoken to my colleagues in provinces and territories, they have worked really well over the last few weeks to prepare for that eventuality. I've just exchanged with one of them today, precisely on the number of pharmacies, schools, and other places where children will be vaccinated. So we have full confidence that this is going to roll out really well.
I talked about it being a game changer. Give me your honest read on what this is going to mean for Canada's national vaccination rate.
Well, first, it's going to be a game changer for millions of families which have gone through very stressful events over the last while. You know, the pandemic has been very harsh on families and on children in particular, with school closures, you know, disruptions in extracurricular activities, social isolation, mental health issues, very important for many, many families and children. So it's going to change the lives of millions of families and children. And never mind the educators, the teachers, and all those who care for our children. Now, it's also a great thing for the overall vaccination portrait in Canada. We are one of the top countries in the world in terms of overall vaccination, but now with children between the ages of 5 and 11 now being eligible to vaccination, that's going to help protect not only themselves, but many others around them.
We're going to have more coming up on the vaccine being approved for children age 5 to 11. But while we have you here, Minister Duclos, on the program on Thursday, U.S. Congressman Brian Higgins telling us that he met with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, and Trudeau told him that Canada's PCR test, that travel requirement, is going to be phased out in three stages. First, Canadians, we know about that, then Americans and everyone else. Can you confirm that?
Well, that's exactly true. Our Prime Minister said it, obviously, so we're going through phases. On November the 30th, as you have mentioned, those Canadians going outside of Canada vaccinated for short trips, less than 3 days, 72 hours, will not need to have what we call a molecular or PCR test when they return to Canada, and we will be assessing the situation. These will still go through random testing as they come back to Canada. It will allow us to check whether that is working appropriately, and as the Prime Minister indicated, we'll be watchful and saying more on the status and the rules for other visitors, including Americans.
Yeah, can you explain the science, though, behind getting rid of the PCR test for fully vaccinated Canadians but not fully vaccinated foreigners?
Well, two reasons. First, these Canadians are leaving the country for a very short time, 3 days, be it by air or by land. And second, the situation outside of Canada is quite different in most parts of the world. Now, just to give you an example, per capita, that is relative to the population, in the U.S., they have four times more new cases than we have in Canada. Per capita, again, in the United States, we have twice as many unvaccinated people as we find in Canada. In the U.K., it's 10 times more new cases per day than in Canada. So the situation outside of Canada is sometimes of great concern, and we need to protect the health and safety of Canadians as we proceed gradually with opening our borders.
Last question. That's why it's difficult for you to give me a timeline about the eventual full phase-out of these sorts of PCR tests.
Well, we'll be obviously following public health advice. They've said that proceeding in this particular manner today was the right thing to do, but they also ask us to be vigilant, and all Canadians to be vigilant. We're entering into the winter season. People will be more indoors, which is going to lead to more contacts and possibly more spread of the virus, more respiratory diseases too. Influenza might come back, colds. So it's going to be important that everyone, including government officials, do their job in not only guiding through great policies, but also the right actions on the part of everyone.
Jean-Yves Duclos is Canada's health minister, joining us from Quebec City. Thank you for this, Mr. Duclos. We appreciate your time.
Thank you, and good night, everyone.
All right, let's dig a little deeper into this big news, vaccines for children. Health Canada giving the green light today after weeks of anticipation. It's going to affect about 3 million children and, of course, their families. First doses potentially beginning next week. It will make Canada one of the first in the world to do this and increase, of course, the total vaccination rate nationally dramatically. About 86% of eligible Canadians who are 12 years and older right now are fully vaccinated. So will this new strategy help protect our country during the winter and prevent any sort of fifth wave? Let's bring in Health Canada's chief medical advisor, Dr. Supriya Sharma. Dr. Sharma, always good to have you on the show, and I appreciate it's a busy day, but coming on our show today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Okay, so what does this approval actually mean here, big picture, for our fight against the pandemic?
Well, it's another tool in the toolkit. We're seeing, as we go through and look at the number of cases of COVID-19 in Canada, that this age group, this 5 to 11 age group, actually represents the highest incidence. And that's, you know, to be expected as we have the older population becoming vaccinated. So we are seeing more cases. We know that this group does have a lower risk of severe illness, but that is not zero. So an authorization for this age group really protects them against severe COVID-19, against other effects of COVID-19 like long COVID and this other syndrome, this multi-system inflammatory disease that can be quite severe. It also will help decrease transmission. So that means fewer other people that might be vulnerable to be very ill with COVID would get exposed. And then the last part of it is that the more people we get vaccinated in Canada, the more we can interrupt that community spread and hopefully get ourselves back to a sense of normality. And last, you know, I think we often talk about the physical impacts of COVID, but I don't think we can underestimate the fact that, you know, kids have gone through really, and families have gone through really difficult times. Obviously, there's a lot of anxiety. There's been, you know, missed school, missed gatherings. So this, you know, the vaccines help add another layer of protection, and both on the physical and the mental side will really help, I think.
Yeah, hallelujah. So true. Now, I have a curious question for you about the three-week interval. NACI recommending 8 weeks in between the first and second doses for children. Health Canada talking about 3 weeks. Can you explain that discrepancy?
Sure. So I'll start with the Health Canada part of it. The evidence that we look at as a regulator, so the people that approve the vaccines, is really looking at the clinical trials. And when we look at those clinical trials, those controlled studies, they used a three-week interval. And that's not new. They did that for, Pfizer did that for the adults as well. It is, you know, it's reasonable to use that interval. It makes the clinical trials go faster. So we would really see that 3 week as a minimum. When NACI looks at it, they're also looking at what we know about the use of COVID-19 vaccines overall, experience with other vaccines, and there's really two reasons why they're recommending a longer interval. One is on the immunity side, and we've seen that with the COVID-19 vaccines, you can get a higher level of immunity, and immunity that lasts longer with a slightly increased interval. And then there's also some evidence that having an increased interval might decrease the risk of some of the side effects that are associated with the vaccines as well, such as the myocarditis, which is the inflammation around the heart. So that's why they recommended the 8 weeks. I think provinces and territories will then move forward with their programs. So most will likely get the second dose after 8 weeks. There may be some exceptions to get it for, you know, in a shorter period of time.
Right. So you're saying that some provinces may choose, Dr. Sharma, to sort of move faster than 8 weeks.
Yeah, so as we said, it's been authorized for anything more than 3 weeks. But, you know, it really is also about seeing, you know, getting those first doses in as many children as possible and that are eligible and that families that are willing to get vaccinated. Mm.
What about parents out there, and I'm sure there are some watching right now, who have concerns, Dr. Sharma, about vaccinating their children?
So first of all, I think it's absolutely normal and natural to have questions and concerns about anything that you give your child, which is whether it's a vaccine or a medication. So first of all, that's absolutely normal. So the second part of it is then what do you need to do? You need to get adequate, accurate, reliable information to help support those decisions. And that's exactly what we're doing. So, you know, one of the things we've seen with this pandemic is that there's also an infodemic. There's a lot of misinformation out there. So what I would say to parents is that, you know, this vaccine is authorized. We would only authorize it at Health Canada if we felt that the benefits outweighed the risks. And so they do for the use of the vaccine. But there is information that we put out, that local public health organizations put out, the provinces and territories put out. And it'd be good to make sure that they take a look at that information, as well as, you know, talk with their healthcare professionals if they have questions, because it's important that they feel comfortable with the decisions that they're making for themselves and their families, and that they feel confident in those decisions.
Yeah, this is a great news story, and I really appreciate you taking the time, giving us your insights and your expertise. As always, Dr. Sharma, thank you.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Supriya Sharma with Health Canada. All right, we're going to go to Abbotsford, British Columbia right now. We're hearing from the mayor there. Of course, the city very hard hit by flooding over the past 5 days. Let's listen in.
Under exploration that would have impacted 22 homeowners. As with all things in an emergency situations, things are very fluid, and I need to be very clear, the levy option is no longer being considered and will not be built. Our crews are considering every option for addressing the situation in front of us. Teams at the site worked overnight to evaluate the situation at the scene and are currently building a temporary replacement for the dike. And we have a photo of this work that Constable Walker said we will share with the media and will post it through our channels. The repair work will be finished before the next rain event, anticipated for early next week. Today, the Canadian Forces military personnel are on site and will be in the area over the coming days, so you may see them out there. Right now, we have 64 soldiers on the ground in Abbotsford, which represents the first arrival of the 120-person Land Task Force response unit that we understand is being deployed to support the city's efforts. As of today, our structural engineers have assessed 10 bridges, and our geotechnical engineers have inspected 32 kilometers of roads and 70 culverts. And I want to pause for a moment because I haven't done enough of this. I do want to acknowledge the immense efforts of our city staff, especially our engineering team and the first responder teams that are leading this emergency response, as well as the contractors who we have mobilized to support us. You know, I looked at the org chart in the back in the war room, what I call the war room. There's at least 70 of our staff that are tasked with leading us through this. And the staff all know who they are, but I want to thank every one of you. Without you, we would never be where we are today. So thank you. Today, 680 people remain evacuated from the Sumas Prairie. At the last update, we had approximately 340 people who have utilized supports through the TradeX evacuation center. We expect more than 60 people will be staying there tonight. We know this continues to be a very stressful time for these people, and we are working around the clock to find the best solutions to get residents access to their homes as soon as possible. The safety of our community remains our number one priority, and the situation remains critical here in Abbotsford. We understand that people are desperate to get home to their property and livestock. Like with all emergencies, it is vitally important for people to heed the advice of our emergency officials and follow the restrictions in place in order to ensure the safety and the safety of our first responders. I've seen photos where we have downed power lines in water. I know it may look safe to people, but it's not safe until we've done assessments of what's out there. That is going on 24/7. My heart goes out to the farmers because they want to get back on their land, but we don't want to lose. We have had no injuries or tragedies that we are aware of as of this moment. And I don't want to have anybody out there as a victim. So please heed the advice. We are there to serve this public and to keep it safe. And with that, I'm going to open it up for your questions. No, see, I did something yesterday, because I know you were looking for a number, and I gave you one. I said between 6 and 12, and then later on I said 10. There's actually 22.
Okay.
So I corrected that. I said I would get the right number.
Yes,
so that's the right number.
And I appreciate that. So just to be clear, given the levy is not going ahead, these 22 homeowners, their properties will not have to be sacrificed at this point?
Well, we were never going to sacrifice them. They were going to be they're already impacted by the water. And they would have been impacted for a longer period of time with the levy, had we gone ahead with the levy construction. So those properties, there will be no additional impact to them beyond what they have been impacted by through the water.
We're hearing that the gap in the dike that is the bigger of the two that you spoke about with the 100-meter gap,
yes,
that's expected to be filled in the next 1 to 2 days?
I have instructed our city manager that I want to see that dike closed before the next rain event, which is scheduled to arrive, I think, Tuesday morning or Monday night. So, yes, the answer is that will be closed.
How big of a task are we talking here? We're seeing dump trucks going in with rocks one by one because there's only so much room. They're lined up ready to go.
Well, this is where the planning session, you know, people, they sometimes say nothing has happened. We don't see anything. There is an enormous amount of work that has been happening in the planning. We are now in the execution stage, and that will happen very rapidly. The logistics of all of that, if somebody wants to know from our engineering staff, I'm happy to provide them to you as a sidebar. But it is an enormous task, and that's why I started off, because when I, you know, up until I even walked in here, I'm getting more information, and I can't answer every phone call. It's just I'm inundated with emails, texts, and so for those that I haven't responded, I'm not ignoring you. My focus is on the safety and this flood event. So
there was a lot of confusion this morning, concern on the ground from residents about whether they're going to be impacted because of the levee or not. People were packing. They were on the move with their personal belongings. As far as the change in the decision, why is the levee no longer needed and the focus is now on fixing the dike?
Because the conditions on the ground have changed. The water has equalized on both sides, so we don't have water pouring into the bowl. And so when we learned this new information, we had some options that we didn't have before. And we things may change in the next 6 hours, and we may, not this part, but we may have to deploy forces in other areas to do something else. I don't know what that is yet, because it hasn't happened. But of the 22 properties, we have talked to 19 of them before this morning, or this last night and this morning. I know some people criticize us because they were caught unaware, and that was probably my fault, because I was giving you the most up-to-date information that I had yesterday at 4 o'clock. And so I made sure our staff, I said, I want everybody contacted. Now, there's three that haven't been. But they all know this, and some of you may have already talked to them about this. Anyways, anybody else?
What makes you confident that the dike can be patched in time for Monday?
The consulting engineers that are working with us, our own engineering staff, and the contractors have been poring over this plan. I have every confidence that this plan, you will see this plan come Tuesday morning, complete. I mean, the breach complete in that 100-meter section, which is 330 feet. And, then of course, we're sourcing contractors as well to start on that second one as well. And we may even bring in a third one. We haven't made those decisions yet, but there's a lot of logistical scheduling and planning that's gone into this. And So
just to be clear on the timing, we're expecting, I believe, a bit of rain Monday, but the rain on Tuesday.
All right, so we've been listening to the mayor of Abbotsford, B.C., east of Vancouver. A frustrating situation there. After 5 days of an extreme flooding situation, the city dealing with evacuations, the community worried, more rain coming in the days ahead. The mayor saying Abbotsford abandoning a plan to build a levee and will instead focus on fixing a dike in the region. The situation very touch and go, and the military is on the ground as well, helping where they can. Let's go live to Abbotsford. CTV's Todd Battis is there. Todd, good to see you. What's the latest to the situation where you are?
Well, Todd, it's interesting to listen to the mayor. We were at that exact spot where we saw those dump trucks coming and going one after another, and presumably they'll be working to get that breach in the dike plugged, really. They're trying to plug a hole and to ensure that there isn't any more flooding. This will be welcome news, I can tell you, to people who live around there, farmers in particular, who are moving things like hay and vehicles and livestock and their own personal effects away from their properties, worried that if they were going to build a levee, and the mayor said so himself, that something like 22 homes, we had heard 6 to a dozen is what he said yesterday, would possibly be destroyed. It needed to be, a casualty to protect the greater good, to make sure that Sumas Prairie, which is what you're seeing right now, that low-lying land in Abbotsford, that it wouldn't continue to flood. So the fact that they're, you know, that they're going to make the decision to plug a hole as opposed to build a levee, I think that'll be welcomed by a lot of people.
The military on the ground, Todd, what kind of help are they offering?
Yeah, well, this is interesting. You know, we know that there was 120 that arrived to the Abbotsford airport. We hadn't seen any evidence of them. To find out from the military exactly what their role would be. You heard the mayor say that there are 64 of those 120 in Abbotsford. It seems, the impression is that their role is not quite defined right now. I mean, certainly if they were brought in to build a levee, and that levee is, it's been determined that they don't need to build a levee, well, that certainly changes the requirement of the soldiers. So what role will they have now? We simply don't know. The fact that you've got extra bodies on the ground, and he has a very tight deadline of getting that dike breach fixed by, the end of Monday, the more people you have to help out, the better. I suppose that the military could be made of use that way.
CTV's Todd Battis in Abbotsford today. Todd, thank you for this.
You bet.
So that's the situation in Abbotsford. We're going to go a little east now to the neighboring city of Chilliwack, B.C. The mayor there is Ken Popoff, and he's standing by. Thank you for taking the time, Mr. Mayor. Appreciate you coming on the program. And give us the latest on what's happening right now in Chilliwack.
And thanks for having me on the program. Certainly, we are not in the same dire strait than the city of Abbotsford is. We are at the eastern end. And we only have about nine families that are evacuated in a low-lying area. Last night, the river rose about an inch and a half, so it is equalizing, as Mayor Braun said. We're quite excited and happy to have that number given to us, because it's a slower rise than what we had expected, but we're actually in pretty good shape here.
You were sandbagging last night to fight off potential flooding.
Yeah, there were some residents in Yarrow that apparently a chicken farm was being sandbagged, and a few personal residences as well, but there's no immediate danger at this point.
I know the airport in Chilliwack has become something of a key lifeline to residents who find themselves cut off from the rest of British Columbia. Tell me about the sustainability of that.
Oh, we have lots of room there, and yeah, I've never seen so many planes and helicopters landing and taking off, and you're correct. We were cut off for a couple of days with no way in and no way out, and that was the only way to go.
Tell me as well about the military deployment. Are you seeing any evidence or any CFA personnel arriving in Chilliwack to help?
I have not seen any yet. I'm not sure what their deployment is going to be, but no, I have not seen any yet.
And what about the forecast calling for more rain in the days ahead?
Well, I feel if Abbotsford can fix that breach in their dike with the pump station still going, I think we'll be okay.
Mm. And what help does Chilliwack need right now?
What help? Well, the supply chain for sure was an issue here a couple of days ago, but I've seen the tanker trucks coming in. I see the freight trucks coming in. I believe the shelves and stores are going to be stocked up. The stations will have their fuel. It's just one day at a time.
So it sounds to me like you're hoping the worst is now over, for Chilliwack anyway.
Yeah, I believe so, sir. I believe so.
Ken Popoff, thanks so much for taking some time. I know it's got to be busy, but getting on these programs, getting the message out is so important. Thank you.
Yeah, it was a stressful week, no question.
Yeah, no, and we salute the work you're doing, no doubt. Meantime, we're following this story, a big legal one in the United States, in the state of Wisconsin, where a jury has cleared an 18-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse on all charges related to deadly shootings that happened in Kenosha, Wisconsin, last summer.
We, the jury, find the defendant, Kyle H. Rittenhouse, not guilty.
Rittenhouse shot and killed two people, wounded a third. The 18-year-old had been charged with homicide, attempted homicide, reckless endangering after shooting those two men, injuring the third, at racial injustice protests that happened in Kenosha in the summer of 2020. His defense lawyers argued that he acted in self-defense. The National Guard is on standby in Kenosha in anticipation of potential unrest following what is definitely a controversial verdict. Stay with us. Communities banding together to get through the devastating flooding in British Columbia, including our next guest, who's taking on fellow farmers' cattle. But how long can this last? We're going to talk to the chair of the BC Dairy Association. That's coming up next here on Power Play. Stay with us. And welcome back. Rescue efforts ramping up in British Columbia. But for those at the center of it, the troubles are far from over. People who live in areas affected by the flooding have been banding together, including the man you're about to meet. His farm has not seen the same devastation as the farms around the Abbotsford area, but he has been helping his fellow farmers, even housing cattle. He says he's seen entire livelihoods submerged under 6 feet of water. So how can the government help those people whose livelihoods are now on the line and some of those livelihoods may be lost? Let's find out. And bring in the chair of the BC Dairy Association, Holger Switchenberg. Thanks for taking the time for Power Play. I appreciate you coming on the show today.
Yeah, thank you for reaching out to us.
Hey, you're joining us from Agassiz. Your farm so far is safe, but you've been doing a lot of work for fellow farmers. Tell us what the situation has been like. What are you seeing?
So on Tuesday afternoon, the 60 dairy farms in the eastern end of the Sumas Prairie had their evacuation orders. And fellow farmers kicked into high gear, trucks, trailers, and got as many animals out of there as they could. Of course, with an evacuation order, you have to leave. The families and the farmers, they left and took as many of the animals with them. And people at my end, the Chilliwack and Agassiz neighbors, they took as many animals as they possibly could. We've got 30 milking cows and 15 dry cows and heifers that we're housing. We're pretty full right now, but we're doing our best to help our fellow farmers. And we've told them, look, we'll take care of your animals as long as it's needed.
We know that that part of British Columbia, you know this very well, of course, the key to the agricultural sector, the breadbasket in a lot of ways. What is this going to mean to some of those farmers' livelihoods?
I'm not going to speculate, but I can imagine that some of those farms, if they've been in 5 or 6 feet of water, there's going to be a fair amount of cleanup required, probably electrical repairs, getting the animals back, assessing the feed inventory, getting bedding back into the barns, farms. So a lot of work will require to get those farms up and running again, but we'll do our best to get that going as quick as possible.
Yeah, and it's just remarkable to see all the people who are coming out, people such as yourself, to help others in need. What kind of help do you think the government can do here?
Again, I don't want to speak on behalf of the government. I think federally and provincially, the cleanup, the road repair, getting farmers up and running again, perhaps helping with repairs, infrastructure upgrade, whatever it takes to get the milk production back to where it was before this all happened.
Right. And the idea of, you know, yet more rain in the forecast and trying to figure out how to prevent something like this from happening again, these are such difficult questions to answer, aren't they?
Yeah, and this was an unprecedented rain event. They had 7 inches of rain in 24 hours. I've got friends on the prairies. They don't get that in a year. So that is an awful lot of water to deal with. And, you know, the Sumas Prairie area is quite low. It's where the water tends to go. And the other problem they have is that the water in Barrowtown is 2 feet lower than the Fraser River. So everything that leaves the prairie, Sumas Prairie, has to be pumped out. It can't flow out. So that adds to the challenge.
And Holger, I'm just curious, what are people saying to you? I mean, just watching this unfold, people you've been helping out. I mean, I know it's a tight community. What are you hearing from people?
Well, I think, first of all, a lot of people are thankful for all the help and the people that step up to, you know, whether it's food, whether it's housing, whether it's providing trucks. I think I also hear a certain amount of frustration because people would like to go back and look after their cattle. But it's an evacuation order, so the authority of emergency services, you need special permits and stuff. But I think everyone's trying to work to the same goal, which is to get as many animals out as we can, make sure the families are safe, and take care of as many of those animals as possible, and then tackle the next problem.
Holger Switchenberg joining us from Agassiz, British Columbia. Listen, thank you so much for taking the time. I know it's been a lot this week, but we really appreciate you taking a bit of time to come on the program today.
Super, and thanks for listening. Take care. Bye-bye.
Holger Switchenberg is the chair of the BC Dairy Association joining us there. All right, coming up for us in just a moment here on Power Play, no win in Washington.
I highlighted over the course of these past 2 days in many, many different conversations Canada's real concerns.
The Prime Minister leaves Washington without any sort of Canadian carve-out on Joe Biden's Buy America agenda. So what happened at this summit? Did we lose out? Our strategy session digs in. That's next.
I highlighted over the course of these past 2 days in many, many different conversations Canada's real concerns about the impact it would have not just on the industry in Canada, but on the integrated.
Well, welcome back. The Prime Minister there addressing Canada's efforts to secure an exemption from U.S. President Joe Biden and his protectionist agenda. Managing the relationship between the United States and Canada is always challenging for any Canadian Prime Minister. And Justin Trudeau coming away from that summit with Biden and, of course, the President of Mexico as well. Joe Biden wants to offer big tax credits on the sale of American-made electric vehicles. That's a program that Canada's U.S. ambassador says would violate the new NAFTA agreement. But when pressed by reporters, the president offered no assurances for Canada. So was this mission a flop, or is it was perhaps the best the government could have hoped for? Let's bring in our strategists who are standing by. Greg McEachran with Proof Strategies. He leans Liberal. We should also make note, of course, that he works with the Canadian Airports Council. Adrienne Batra, the editor-in-chief of the Toronto Sun. She's our Conservative voice. Let's bring in Anne McGrath as well. She is the NDP's national director. And rounding out our session, Greg Weston from Earnscliffe Strategy. He's got the nonpartisan point of view. Good to see all four of you, and happy Friday. And Greg McEachran, let me start with you here. And the best Canada could have hoped for when it comes to dealing with a president who, as all of us know, is more friendly to Canada, but nevertheless has a lot of pressure when it comes to Buy American.
Yeah, two kind of takeaways on that. One is the message that, you know, just having them in the same room sends, which is to all of us, you know, when I saw the video, in your introduction of Minister Joly and Mr. Freeland standing behind the Prime Minister with a mask on, I immediately thought, oh, I forgot my mask. We're still very much in COVID mind. But when we see international meetings like this reoccur, that's a good thing. But also in this case, under President Trump, these meetings ended. And in some ways, much worse for, you know, Mexico than for Canada. That border wall is still not built. But, you know, there was some very insulting comments by the previous president. So I think, you know, if we're looking for the positive here at the glass, you know, half full, I think the fact that we can actually have these conversations in a clear and sensible manner is a good thing. We talked last week, Todd, about, you know, this is not unexpected with Democrats in terms of, protectionism. I do think it was important for the Prime Minister to be in the room and push back. And as Ann and I talked about last week, you know, in terms of auto, both sides of the border, the labor, element of the auto pact, I'm sure the Prime Minister made that very clear to the President of the importance of this, especially around new electric vehicles.
And there's so much going on for Joe Biden. I mean, as we know, he's trying to get laws passed and infrastructure bills and massive social spending. He's dealing, of course, with the pandemic, and then he's hosting, you know, the Canadian Prime Minister, the Mexican President as well. He left Washington calling this effective. That was Justin Trudeau's way of describing it. Adrienne Batra, was it effective?
Well, I mean, nice photo ops and good collegial pictures is going to be very cold, little comfort for those many thousands of Canadians whose jobs are, frankly, at risk based on this one clause within Joe Biden's Buy Better Back America Act. I mean, it's really problematic. And I have no doubt that Prime Minister Trudeau and the group of other ministers that he took with him made the case and made it strenuously. But you're dealing with a president right now who is not strong, is vulnerable on his own many domestic issues. So he is really bargaining this Buy Back America chip as, you know, looking for a re-election bid and, of course, looking at the midterms. So unfortunately, within all of that, Todd, Canada loses, and Canada is going to lose big time with this legislation. We couldn't convince the U.S. government to take out that one clause of purely Buy America and bring it back to what was originally negotiated under USMCA. So that's going to be the sticking point. We're now going to have to sit back and wait for the industry and union leaders to actually get to soften this deal that the federal government was unable to do.
And McGrath, what kind of options do we actually have, though? I mean, we can be upset about this and we can grumble about it, but at the end of the day, I mean, really, what are the effective tools in the toolbox?
Well, I mean, I do think it was good that there was that sounds like the reports are anyway, that there was a fairly strenuous opposition to this expressed at the summit in Washington. I also think, though, that we have to be very clear that what we need to do here is we either need that clause withdrawn or there needs to be an exemption for Canada. And there is such an integrated supply chain, too, that it'll be very hard to enforce, even if it was kept in. But again, going back to a little bit of what we were talking about last week, I do think that there are some, you know, Joe Biden is very union friendly, which I think is a good thing. And so our union leaders here in Canada, I think particularly in the auto sector with Unifor or with the United Steelworkers Union or United Food and Commercial Workers Union, they have to be talking to their counterparts in the United States. Because I think that in addition to our kind of bilateral engagement on this, there has to be domestic pressure on Joe Biden from the union leaders, from the business sector, and of course, even when it goes to the Senate, there's some indications that there may even be a Democrat or two who will not be voting with him on this.
Yeah, and I mean, there are so many competing priorities for U.S. President Greg Western. It also, to me, is interesting when I look at the coverage of this kind of a story, this summit in the American media, where it gets a whole lot less attention than it does, of course, in the Canadian and Mexican media. We can certainly understand why that happens. But this notion that, you know, being in the room is important, relationships are important. This president and our prime minister certainly get along a whole lot better than Donald Trump did with Justin Trudeau, calling him weak and dishonest. That helps, and yet it only goes so far, correct?
Yeah, I think there's always a temptation to overestimate the importance of these meetings in substantive terms. This is about getting along, or more to the point, as we saw between Trudeau and Trump, it can be the news of the day can be they're not getting along, which is not a good thing. So, it's good that they get along, but Anne is right. This is going to be settled domestically. The whole car issue, the one positive thing that came out, and this is a very small shred, was Biden saying it's not law yet, and it's not. It still has to pass the Senate, and there's a West Virginia senator we know who thinks this is wrong and may have the ability to block it. So it's not a done deal yet, but if it is defeated in the states, it'll be defeated by domestic pressures. It'll be all of those 35 states that depend on Canada for trade who are afraid that we might retaliate. We saw this after Trump imposed tariffs on steel. Canada comes back, imposes countermeasures, counter tariffs that hurt those 35 states. They go to the president, they pressure him. That's the kind of thing that's going to happen here if this moves any forward. I still think it's a 50-50 bet that the Senate, it doesn't get past the Senate. But aside from that, hey, they got along. They didn't fight. Nobody got into trouble. That's not a loss.
There we go. Okay, let's move on to trouble for the Conservative Party of Canada and turmoil under the big blue tent for Erin O'Toole, of course, party leader, after Conservative Senator Denise Batters booted out of the Conservative caucus after launching a petition calling for a review into Erin O'Toole's leadership. But she is staying in the Senate Conservative caucus. Back to you, Greg McEachran. The trouble that this means for Erin O'Toole.
Yeah, Senator Batters is probably one of the most partisan voices from the Conservative Party, period, but also from the Senate. She got in trouble a couple of years ago for a comment she made about MP Omar Al-Ghabra, about, you know, where he was born and whether or not, you know, seeming to suggest that it had somehow affected his judgment. She had to apologize for that. And so she said a lot of these things. I don't think anybody really is, you know, really wanted to warm up to a lot of her tweets. And it reminds me of a rather inelegant saying that Lyndon Johnson had about political colleagues in tents. But they stood by her for a long time, and then all of a sudden, you know, they stood by her till they didn't. I think it's interesting that there are other people in the Conservative caucus who have said similar things, and they've not been kicked out. And it, you know, I can't help but think of back in 2019 when Jane Philpott and Jody Wilson-Raybould left the Liberal caucus. There were a lot of conservatives that had a lot to say about how they felt that women were being treated. But you don't see anything right now about a female conservative senator being kicked out of caucus. People are very quiet on that. So again, sometimes this just proves that people don't really care about the issues. They just care about the issues that they can use to batter around another political opponent. And I'll just wrap up with this, Todd. I've been very tough on Erin O'Toole, but one of the things he did do well in the last couple of weeks was leave out of his critics the people that have not been embracing science and not been pro-vaccine. And I think, you know, that step probably had a little bit more to do with some of the people rallying against him to end his leadership. And it's too bad he chose science. The base is unhappy with him.
It's been about 2 months since the federal election, as you know, Adrian Batra, in which, of course, Erin O'Toole lost. And I'm curious, you know, he often tries to be all things to all people. The challenge he is going to face now, we're seeing Denise Batra, she's not alone. Is this inevitable? This is going to get more and more ugly.
Well, let's dispel right away this whole notion of, you know, being treating a woman one way versus how another party leader treated women. I would hardly put treating getting Senator Batters out of the Conservative caucus is the same way as, you know, the manner by which, you know, Jody Wilson-Raybould or Selena Chavez was treated. So let's just dispel that for a moment. But I can sum up what Senator Batters is doing with one word: unhelpful. Unhelpful to the party, unhelpful to the country, unhelpful obviously to the leader, and unhelpful to herself. I have no doubt that the good senator believes that there is a fraction of the caucus of the party that she's representing. But the reality is, when you talk to actual members of parliament, elected members of parliament, she's not. And this is not going to be, you know, a short-lived situation, because as we've seen, Senator Batters, she's very tough, and she won't go without a fight. She is, of course, an Andrew Scheer loyalist. We all know that, you know, all of us from my home province of Saskatchewan, Todd. But this is just really a time when the opposition party should be doing their job and really holding the Liberal government's feet to the fire. This distraction is only helpful for Justin Trudeau and does nothing good for the big blue tent that Erin O'Toole attempted and was attempting to open up.
And Anne McGrath, obviously, you know, the senator, Denise Batters, speaks on behalf of others in the caucus, some more overt than others, with concerns about O'Toole's leadership and the promises that were made in the election, which she felt violated, you know, key core principles of the party.
Yeah, I mean, the fundamental problem that Erin O'Toole has faced since the leadership is that he ran as one person and then campaigned as a different person. He ran for the leadership as the true blue conservative, very right wing, got Leslyn Lewis on side, who is also very, very right wing. So really kind of presented himself as the sort of the you know, representative of whatever are considered sort of true conservative values as a contrast to Peter MacKay, but then has been attempting to, I think, pull the party a little bit more to the center and ran the campaign, a more centrist campaign than he had indicated when he ran for leader. And so that creates just really some irreconcilable differences and problems in the party. I do believe, however, that the decision to kick Senator Batters out of caucus has kind of been a bit of a bracing thing for a lot of people. And we are starting to see some of the MPs in particular kind of pulling together and rallying around him, because I think that they recognize that whether the complaints about him are true or not, this is not going to be, this could, you know, if this continues on, it could be very, very damaging. Right. So I think that there is a sort of a certain sense of a core group that recognizes that whatever their complaints with him, this kind of infighting is very, very damaging and poisonous.
We're almost out of time, but Greg Weston, your quick take on this.
Well, I'll just remind everybody that once upon a time, Justin Trudeau kicked out all the Liberal senators and nobody really cared. So I'm not sure.
I think the senators cared.
Playing under Senator Batters' demise. Look, This was an easy show of muscle for Aaron O'Toole. He had to lower the boom on somebody, and you might as well lower the boom on somebody who's not particularly popular to start with. Politics is an ugly game. It just got played.
Listen, thanks to all four of you for coming on the show today. Really appreciate it. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Todd.
And that's Powerfully for today. I'm Todd Vanderhaeghen. Evan Solomon is back on Monday. From all of us here on the show, have a great weekend ahead.